This is the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Most of our discussions on politics, economics, and culture are now also available to watch on our YouTube channel. In this week's press review, Alistair Benn and Ian Martin chose the stories in the media that grabbed them, from the possibility of eternal life to the Northern Ireland Protocol, and from Anglo-French relations to the Beatles. Here is the whole show.
Alistair, what's your first pick of the week? A story from The Guardian, I think.
So, yeah, it's Andy Beckett, who I think is well known for writing a book about the 70s and a sort of shortage Britain. And he's written a piece called The Conservatives Are in More Danger Than They Think. Thought it was a good piece for two reasons, in that it, well, one reason was that it chimes with my own thinking about what the actual point of danger is for the Tories. Because I think over the last couple of months, people have sort of had the vague sense that there's this vague sense of arrogance at the top. There's a sense that Boris's leadership style is not maybe one that's suitable for crises. The piece basically argues that, you know, what could really damage them is a kind of cascading shock that just kind of, you know, to quote Tony Blair, kind of puts the kaleidoscope in, whatever he said, the kaleidoscope
has been shaken.
So I think my own thoughts about that is people have misread the last couple of months, and that they've basically argued that the problem is Boris doing stuff like raising national insurance or creating a new levy. But I think that's actually overstated. People generally accept a tax rise like national insurance if it's for something they want to have happen. And health and social care, people want the health service to be better funded.
There's a logic to it also, isn't there, after the pandemic, that people, I mean, I'm personally opposed to it. I think the last thing the government should be doing should be hiking taxes at the moment, because it sends the wrong signal to investors and to consumers. But you can see the logic. I mean, I'm in two minds about this this question about the Tory poll position. You know, how robust is it? Because in a way, the Tories can't believe their luck. They're still, but it feels a little bit like it felt after Northern Rock, for example, when I think, you know, Labour, things calmed down and Labour, I think, still had a poll lead, or Labour was still, something was going wrong with the financial system, but it wasn't yet the explosion of autumn 2008. So is it a moment like that? Or is it, and are they, as Andy Beckett says, you know, about to be hammered just by this, as you said, you know, this cascade of calamity on energy prices, fuel, that sort of thing. But then the advantage that the Tories have, and it does, it's their lead, which would suggest the lead is solid, is that because Boris reunited the Brexit vote at the time of the 2019 election, essentially just adding on top of the Tory vote, the Brexit Party vote, which was a rebellion against the political class, that gets them to about 40%, doesn't it? It seems that no matter what you throw at those voters at the moment, they have made up their mind to sort of generally just let the government get on with it.
Yeah, so it's sort of deep structural things on his side, but that, you know, all of that is true until it isn't. You know, kind of shocks like that, like the financial crisis, or shocks, you know, the energy shock that is going on in the world economy, whatever Boris burbles about it just being the world economy waking up, or it's just growing pains, is not plausible to me. The economy, it's a delicate, you know, complex modern economies are delicate, intrinsically fragile and delicate, and rely on a very delicate balance of confidence, consumer confidence, of people making decisions, of good leadership and strong leadership. You know that better than me through your writing on RBS and financial shocks. You know, that, like, it is a very, very unstable situation at the moment. And it has really struck me, and again, this is just potentially being a commentator on this sort of issue, you overstate things. There's a tendency to overcorrect after the pandemic and maybe be more doom and gloom than maybe I certainly was in February last year. I just thought, well, it's going to blow over or something. But it just seems to me like there are so many sort of warning signs going off. And who do you want in charge? I mean, Boris in the last crisis, it is obvious that he cannot, he's very bad at crisis management. And whatever, and actually, whatever good people are around him are affected by his, whatever it is, his chaos, his inability to focus, all the kind of leadership problems that have been stacking up. Why it doesn't resonate with the public in the same way as, you know, things are often crystallized, you know, over time. With Gordon Brown, it was crystallized very quickly, as we've seen with things like the Blair Brown. You know, it was almost, he went from this sort of strong figure to someone who was seen as very weak and indecisive quite quickly.
That's true. But Alistair, people don't then, I mean, I think it's a good set of questions posed by, you know, by Andy Beckett, but people don't follow politics in that way, do they? Most voters think about politics every few years. And they were forced, I wonder if this might be a side effect of Brexit, they were forced to think about politics because it was just so dominant during the Brexit, you know, that disastrous period before the 2019 election. They were forced to think about it more than they would normally like to. And I wonder if there's just a bit of a backlash against that they're tuning out. So I will, just letting the government get on with it. For my first choice, I've actually, rather than, the show's called Press Review, and of course we review, you know, newspapers, magazines, podcasts, stuff that's grabbed us from around the world. But Twitter also counts. And I was very struck this week by the way in which the story played out on Twitter on the UK and the Northern Ireland Protocol negotiations or crisis, if you like, with between the EU and the UK. The way in which the initial reports came out saying EU offers major concessions, deal must be in prospect. And a couple of Twitter threads emerged which caught my eye, which gave a really good insight and analysis. And so the first one was Anton Spisak, who works for the Tony Blair Institute. And he had a really interesting thread where essentially he acknowledges that the EU has made some concessions, will be seen as a small victory by many in London. Remember that the big philosophical argument with the EU has been on the extent to which flexibilities like this were possible at all. So this is what fascinates me. Most of what the EU has conceded used to be termed magical thinking. I mean, there was no possibility of such flexibility, but now it seems that it is, which raises the question about whether the UK government is doing the right thing or the wrong thing. The right thing, I would say, by actually negotiate by pushing things quite hard. But he raises the point that it's, although there are concessions made, once you actually dig into the practicalities of it, the point also made by Raoul Raparel, who's a former UK government advisor, who makes a similar series of points about actually once you get into the detail, you see that there's all sorts of areas where the EU hasn't moved that are still going to be problematic, for certainly for the unionist community in Northern Ireland. Anton Spisak says, most notably on customs, proposals introduce a new idea of structural safeguards, things the UK could do if the UK doesn't comply with you know, obligations here, no changes to the VAT system. So you're into the absolute, you know, the weeds on things like medicines as well, and which medicines are allowed to be, you know, do they need the approval of EU regulators as well? And essentially it says, but the conditions for the UK are pretty strict, ongoing application of the relevant EU legislation and enhanced surveillance system. I mean, I think what's now about to happen is your David Frost, as we record this, is in Brussels. Negotiations are about to start, they think, probably leading to 3 or 4 weeks of talks. I just thought it was noteworthy that with a, you know, with a, there's a couple of examples there of people who are following this very closely, and the links to those Twitter threads are below. Your next choice, Alistair, is I think actually from Engelsberg Ideas, and related in a, at a tangent, but related to this question of EU-UK relations, but through the prism of what's going on between Britain and France.
Yeah, so I asked James Barr, who's a brilliant historian, a historian actually of the Middle East and the how the Anglo-French relationship has played out there in part. But I asked James to write a sort of essay on the Anglo-French relationship over time. And his point is that it's always been a testy relationship, at times kind of infuriating to both sides. But when the chips are really down, there is a kind of coming together. So, and the clever point is, well, we kind of don't need to worry about the kind of squabbling at the moment, because the chips are not quite down. But when Britain and France come together, then we need to think, oh God, things are actually really bad.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant essay because it kind of, it takes you through all the kind of different inflections of the relationship, and the paranoia, it really struck me that has sometimes been a real feature on both sides of the channel. You know, in the early 20th century, there was huge paranoia on in England about a potential French invasion. There was paranoia in France throughout the whole 20th century about Britain's role in the Middle East. And, you know, a lot of interesting, he puts a lot of great anecdotes in. I think it's important to sort of, why I commissioned it actually, was because there's an awful loss of tripe being talked about the Entente Cordiale and the Lancaster House agreements. And there's this kind of notion that Anglo-French relationship is now in such a dire state. It was in a relatively good state, and now we're in this kind of real nadir. We're not quite tripe, and there's a certain truth to it. But I think people need to get real and have a bit of a long view on this. You know, there is going to be strategic competition between Britain and France. There are different strategic interests at play in Europe, in other hot geopolitical zones across the world. There have been so many signals on the French side that they wish to take a different view, for example, on China, which is the defining geopolitical contest of our century. Yeah. So I don't buy this idea that it's Britain sort of sailing off on its own and trashing its alliances. And, you know, there's this other reality where Britain and France are sort of collaborating all the time, talking lockstep. I'm sorry, you know, we have both countries actually have signaled over quite a long period that you know, there is going to be huge collaboration on defence issues, on that kind of material side of things, but there is going to be a different take on certain issues.
It's a really good piece by James. If you're watching this and you haven't yet seen Engelsberg Ideas EI, which is another site that Alistair and I work on, that the reaction team helps to produce. The address is below. You can also subscribe and you get a weekly email, which is free. So tune in and read James's excellent essay. But there is this weird duality, isn't there? That the French and UK relationship is happening on two levels, as you described. It is on a day-to-day basis in terms of defence cooperation. We've talked about it a lot before. There's tons of cooperation, and the two nations' armed forces are effectively interwoven and share capability, and that pooled capability makes both stronger. But then politically, the relationship between Boris, which you know James alludes to, between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron seems to be completely broken, and people I speak to say that it seems unfixable. And it is. It's odd because their relationship started out being very positive. I know that sounds odd, but Macron found him obviously much more entertaining than Theresa May, and could talk to him in French about French history. Boris likes French wine, and found the whole thing, found him amusing and interesting, but also quite a serious thinker on geopolitics. That was Macron's first initial take on him, which is then soured because of the mess of Brexit, the Brexit talks, and then AUKUS. It now seems as though they just don't, they're not communicating in the way that they were, and the relations are in the deep freeze. Be interesting to see whether there's some act of statecraft which can fix that, or whether that's just how it's going to run until Macron stops being president or Boris stops being prime minister, whenever that is. My next choice is I just want to flag this up, and the link is below, just because I thought it was a very powerful contribution from Professor Robert Winston on BBC Question Time this week, where the thorny question of trans rights and the debate over what's been happening is Kathleen Stock at Sussex University in the last week or so. So it's very much a live issue. But he, and as I say, the link is below, just gave a very clear explanation of how, which seems to me at the heart of it, that if you want a resolution to this, or an intelligent way to think about it, which doesn't lead to conflict, it is that, of course, people can change their gender. But that the biological sex is unchangeable. And he says that in a very crisp and clear and calm way, and then says, but even the act of saying this on BBC Question Time means that he will then get torrents of hate mail. So I just wanted to flag that up. Your next choice, Alistair, I think is from the New Statesman.
Yes, it's Jenny Clayman, who's written a great long read on the anti-aging industry. And the title is Immortality Inc., Born in Silicon Valley, the anti-aging industry is booming, but who wants to live forever? Well, it turns out quite a lot of people do want to live forever, quite amazingly to any reasonable right-thinking person, quite frankly. And you read this, it's a great piece because you interview all these really clever, they're very clever scientists and all working in these cool startups. They've got backing from these billionaires like Peter Thiel, and all the mood music is, no one's ever going to die of cancer again once we've changed it. No one's going to die of Alzheimer's again, or die with Alzheimer's. And the idea really is this, and it's very well illustrated in the piece, is that while death is inevitable, aging isn't. So it's saying that, we might die eventually, but you don't have to go through the aging process to get there. In fact, we have over the next 20 or 30 years, we'll develop all these kinds of interventions, like prophylactic drugs for aging. So you'll take a pill, almost like a statin, that regenerates your cells in some ways, or, just stops the aging process. And then there's a very funny sort of skeptical view put by an academic, which just says, well, these people have not thought about what they're doing. What happens in a world with 3 billion 100-year-olds who definitely don't want to work anymore, but just want to watch Amazon Prime and consume, have nice food or whatever people want to do at that age? Well, yeah, you're going to have a situation, not quite Malthusian, but it's not going to be a happy world. And, in that society, what's the point of dynamism? If you've got all the things that you've always loved, you're not going to want new things.
Yeah.
And there's just so many things sort of, you read this stuff and you just think to these sort of young scientists or these, West Coast types, just read some, honestly, just read some books, read literature about dying, read like Turgenev or Tolstoy or Greek tragedy or the myths, you know, Prometheus and the curse of the curse of knowledge, or the curse of the curse that we all live with, which is, you know, that we are alive and that we are constantly trying to transgress our limits, and, you know, those kind of the limits that are put on us find a funny way of getting back to us. And it's just like, yeah, all that, those messages, I just think they'd all enjoy, I think, having a bit of time with, yeah, the humanities, all these anti-aging types.
It's a really good piece. Of course, the problem is that when I'm, you know, I can remember being your age when it all seems very distant, and then I have to say, as time passes, I mean, it's probably what you described was probably too late for me, but you time passes and actually you think, well, you know, when you get into your 50s and 60s, this all seems, you know, frighteningly close. Also,
but Ian, you'll be fine, and it's still fine for you.
Let's hope so.
But in the piece, he says so. It's in your 40s and 50s. They're going to be drugs in like 15 years, where all the aging processes are, and we've all lived to 150. And, you know.
But that raises a question, though. The piece raises a question about what's a model of the economy can support this, because I think there will be people who want to work into their. Now people, many people working into their 70s, and some people starting, you know, some people working into their 80s now as well, and with no desire to or inclination to give up. So I think when you couple that with what's happened with the birth rate this week, which the latest ONS figures show, it's down, and, you know, it's falling in the UK, which is really troubling sign for a society and an economy, because it needs to regenerate itself. Though I suspect the UK economy, once you get over the Brexit difficulties of the moment, I suspect that the UK will go back to being post-crisis a pretty high immigration economy. So I think the population will be replenished that way, but we'll see. That brings its own stresses and strains. But as you say, did you say 3 billion people globally of 100? That's the prospect. But then also, if you
you're right on the, that's the most interesting bit actually, is how you think about those, that in terms of economics. And it's like, surely you just get into a position where you have an underclass of people who have to work manual jobs until they drop, who definitely cannot afford these new wonderful therapies. That's for the next 100, you know, there's no way these kinds of therapies get distributed at cost to the whole world. You would have a sort of normal age limit world where everyone makes everything for these 110-year-olds. You can't, let's be honest, are probably going to have their cognitive skills, but they're not going to, you know, you're not going to be able to do heavy labor, or it's not going to be self-sufficient. So I just think they all need
I'm
to
50,
just,
I can't even do that now, but yeah.
But yes. They just need to I just think bright-eyed Americans in general just need to look at the woes that have been wrought in the world by other bright-eyed, idealistic Americans, whether that's, you know, wherever. I mean, lots of great things, overreach.
But that is, for all the doom and gloom about America, it is an optimistic culture, isn't it? Because it's newer, but it is just gripped with gets these notions and gripped by these exciting ideas. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction on YouTube, just hit the subscribe button below this video, and also it'd be great if you could like this video as well, if you did like it, assuming that you did. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, the main site, and you want to read all the work that the team does, and you get my weekly newsletter on politics, which comes out on a Saturday morning, explaining hopefully what's going on, the link is below. Become a subscriber. At the moment, we are if you become an annual subscriber this month, you get a free copy as a welcome gift of The Life and Reign of Britain's Most Misunderstood Monarch, George III, by the brilliant historian Andrew Roberts. It's a really, really good book, and we send it to you as a welcome gift. So become an annual subscriber. My next pick, I think my last pick, is something slightly unusual. It's from a site which I read every week from the US. It's called Airmail, which was started by Graydon Carter, who people will be familiar with as the editor of Vanity Fair back in the day. And Airmail, you know, a little bit like Reaction, but with a US focus, and they're very interested in culture. Really interesting email that you can sign up to. But they have a terrific piece this week by Michael Lindsay Hogg, who is a film director, and he directed the original Let It Be film in 1970, recorded in 1969. And it's just wonderful to get his perspective. I must admit, I didn't realize he was still around, and so hail and hearty. And to explain for those who don't know what Let It Be is, the film, and it's just being remade or recut or turned, all the footage is being made into a massive sort of three-part project, which comes out later this year. And the book came out this week, and looks rather lovely. I'm certainly going to be buying a copy. But the Let It Be project was essentially when the Beatles, approaching the end of their career together, decided, very much a Paul McCartney idea, as Michael Lindsay Hogg explains in the piece, they'd recorded Hey Jude and various other things and Revolution. They'd recorded videos for those songs at Twickenham Studio, St. Margaret's, near where we used to live, actually, and had such a good time doing it that they had an idea to return with a live TV special. They hadn't played in front of a live audience since 66, San Francisco, Candlestick Park. And Michael Lindsay Hogg gets the great gig of recording them rehearsing, and the idea is it's going to turn into a TV special. The rehearsals, it depends how you view it. And apparently this new version of the film casts things in a different light. It's always seen by Beatles obsessives like me as the moment in which they really break down and start squabbling among themselves. And it's when the Beatles really can run out of road, and the tensions between McCartney and Harrison are very, very apparent. And then it ends, they sort of scrap the rehearsals, go to their HQ in Savile Row, and of course then play the famous rooftop concert, which is seen as their farewell. Though of course they then go back into the studio and make Abbey Road as a proper farewell. So I just highlight the piece because it's a lovely, poignant piece by Michael Lindsay Hogg, reflecting on he was there at the heart of things in the 60s, writes beautifully, and it's on Airmail. So I recommend that.
The Reaction editors there with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism. On Sunday, a video discussing the report into the government's handling of the COVID crisis will be released on our YouTube channel. But here's a preview.
Alistair, what did you make of the report? Because it's interesting, it sort of landed, seemed to be a huge deal. It was a sort of 24-hour media storm. Do you think, there's that terrible phrase, lessons must be learned, so that, you know, how Britain always responds to disasters and then moves on quickly. What did you make of it?
Two things that I think were sort of the two big stories that came out of it, I think are both do not reflect actually our experience with COVID fundamentally, but they reflect very powerful media narratives that have become very, very solidified over the last year. One was the argument over timings of the first lockdown.
Yeah.
Should we have gone into lockdown a week earlier, and how many lives would then have been saved in sort of raw numbers? And it's, the argument is, you know, we could have saved X number of lives by doing this intervention then. I don't think that's one. There are two reasons why that is it's a flawed way of looking at it. One, Raghib Ali, who's involved with the MRC biostatistics unit in Cambridge, who does a lot of modelling of COVID, has repeatedly said throughout the pandemic, every country that suppressed COVID sort of big time in the spring of March 2020 and April experienced worse waves, COVID waves in the wintertime. So expressing, you know, saying that X number of lives would have been saved at that moment is, you know, it's not nuanced enough to reflect that, you know, lives saved in March may well have contributed to worse health collapse in December. Yeah. There is actually a lot of evidence that we experienced a very bad second wave because to some degree the health system, had serious difficulties. And so I find that, I also think it's not a good way of talking about death. We should talk about the way people die and whether those deaths that happened in March and April were people dying well. And I don't think they were. And that was because of lack of preparation, not enough resources.
Yeah.
The situation in care homes and where, I think a lot of people died alone because of the problems with PPE and all that. And because of the kind of emergency situation. These are the things we should be talking about, not political game point scoring on X number of deaths here versus X number of deaths there. The second aspect is, which I think the media took up from the report, is kind of the reflection that came out was, if we'd done an autumn lockdown that, you know, earlier, then we might have prevented what happened in December and January. I don't know what this amorphous autumn lockdown might have looked like. In Wales, the government did what Sage was suggesting, a circuit breaker lockdown in September for 2 weeks, and they experienced effectively the same winter wave, actually in more extreme form, because it rebounded very fast.
And there's a trade-off, right? I can understand, understand the concern, and we, you know, it was a terrible to the second wave, but the reality is that children had, school pupils had what was effectively a normal, they had, at least after all of the disruption, they had a sort of normal start to the school year and were in school. Is the suggestion that actually we should have just completely cancelled in-person schooling? The schools wouldn't have returned in September because everyone would be into full lockdown that then finished, well, when? June? July? The social costs of doing that are would have been enormous. Mm. I suppose the thing that I thought the report landed very well and was very cleverly written, and I watched quite a bit of the evidence sessions, as I'm sure other people did, and I do think they got to the heart of some very important things. Essentially, the period that fascinates me, whether or not this in the end will make any difference in terms of deaths, as it kind of levels out across the Western world, and you'll see that over the course of 2-3 years, death rates are sort of broadly similar. I'm not predicting that, just I suspect that may turn out to be the case, no matter how you responded. But that's no defense of the system failure that happened, that Dominic Cummings has talked really quite eloquently about in February 2020, when you think back, I don't want to use the word stockpiling, but we were, you, me, you know, all sorts of people were quietly just sort of building up some resilience and supplies at home, which actually just was not panic, but just turned out to be a sensible thing considering what happened in March and April. And the UK government, and I took false assurance from it, as I'm sure many people did. You know, I wrote at the time, the government is following the science, which now seems an incredibly naive thing to have thought and to have written. But I did take comfort from the fact that we apparently had a very good pandemic plan on various academic studies. Britain had come, near the top in terms of pandemic preparedness. And then that horrible realization, which happens inside government, Cummings and others, Ben Warner, various people realize it's preparedness for the wrong sort of pandemic. It's a plan for a flu style pandemic, not for not for what's coming. And then the scramble in March to make the Prime Minister realize this and wake up to it, which he does. And there's a 6-week period there where, from really Brexit night, 31st of January 2020, through to the middle of March, where the government machine is just not functioning properly. The Prime Minister isn't there for large parts of it. And I know ministers say, well, he didn't have to be at Cobra, but he is actually away doing whatever he's doing at critical points, and exhausted after the election. If you were looking for defences of Boris Johnson, he was exhausted. Brexit had just happened, but he wasn't fully tuned in a way that... Now, some people say this wouldn't make any difference, but I think if you'd had a Thatcher or a Brown-style figure in that February, in position, asking questions, one of the main jobs of ministers is just to interrogate intelligently the official advice to test the underlying assumptions. And if that had been done, we would have had a sort of 3 or 4 week head start in terms of preparing the health service, sourcing PPE, and then giving instructions to people, whether that's lockdown or not, but just avoiding gatherings, changes to behavior, some of which was happening naturally, wasn't it, in that month anyway. But the government could have then broadcast that and tried to alter behavior rather than doing it in a sudden rush as they realize they've got it wrong. Is that fair?
Yeah, if you don't think leadership matters in the British system, then you don't know about British political history. It is literally the main feature. It's a weakness of the British system, but it's also a strength when you get the right people in charge. The Prime Minister has an exceptional authority in the British system in normal times. In an emergency, he is, you know, acquires even more authority. It is, you know, it matters. If you look at any crisis in the last 100 years and you look at the response, the responses that have been judged by history have done well, whether they were, you know, everything is mixed and there's shades of grey. It involves people at the top paying maximum attention and having very, very clear systems which work fluidly and which, you know, there's constantly going back and forwards. It's a kind of this idea of the supreme command where everything is flowing back through the Prime Minister and out again through a dedicated group around him. This is what Gordon Brown managed to do in the financial crash. And it's what lots of prime ministers have been able to do. I'm sorry, but Boris, you know, whatever his strengths, didn't do that, let's be honest. Yeah. And that was what actually created the moral tragedy of March and April, which is people, different bits of the government sending people actually to their deaths because of the dysfunction. So the care homes and hospitals and people being shunted around, the Nightingales being built for no reason, as it turned out. All these different bits are explained by a lack of, you know, that peculiar authority and the people around him not being able to do it. Boris got ill, of course he did. That was terrible. He almost died. Enormous sympathy. But he wasn't ill for, you know, most of the crisis time.
February and March.
And that no one was able to step up is actually a judgment on his leadership style. A guy who cannot tolerate strong ministers, who hasn't been able to, has appointed lots of people who he sees, I think, as people who are not threats. And I think is that fair? Maybe that's a harsh judgment, but you know. I think, was it Raab took over, who apparently was good at chairing meetings? Well, that's not a skill. That's a skill in a normal time. That's a good thing, but it's not the skill we're looking for in an emergency. I think you're right. Is the report does get into that stuff, and it's very illuminating.
Yeah.
But it's not stuff that we didn't, that any intelligent observer or someone who has read the runes in terms of what Dominic Cummings, who was at the centre of it, has been saying, can work out. And we are going to have crises in the next 10 years that are significant. We need better leaders, and we need better people at top.
There's a full public inquiry to come, of course, but what happened this week is, of course, a start.
That was Alistair Benn and Ian Martin. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is the Reaction Podcast. And until next week, thank you for listening.